Welcome back to the Greg Kelly Podcast. Hello. Yes, it's me. Off Twitter, quite frankly, and I feel pretty good about it. It's giving me less tension, and I have more bandwidth to think about other things and do other things, like watch Netflix shows. What did I watch? I watched the first show I've watched in a long time. I watched a documentary about Frank Sinatra, and it was actually pretty good. What a guy, huh? Look, it doesn't feel right what's happening right now. It feels like I don't like that I can't say whatever the hell I want, whenever the hell I want to say it, how I want to say it. So I do. So I say that stuff. Now, when I do, I feel like I'm incurring some risk. And you really shouldn't, not in America. And I'm not talking about risk from, the scorn of my neighbors or even some friends or whatever. You wonder about the government. Would the government take an interest in the stuff I'm talking about, even privately? Did you see that nitwit press secretary with the red hair say that they are going to be looking at Facebook postings, and there's a way to evaluate text messaging to find out if bad information is being passed about the vaccine? Now, I don't know if there's such thing as bad information about the vaccine. Here's what I mean. Well-educated doctors can disagree about it. They can. Now, I got vaccinated, and I felt miserable after it. I'm not going to engage in any public relations campaign telling people to get vaccinated, because I don't want anybody to go through what I went through based on my advice. Okay, does that make sense? I'm not anti-vax, but I think I am not anti being forced to get vaccinated. It's up to each and every individual. Fair enough, because they force you to do things in places like North Korea, in places like Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And we don't like those places, right? But more and more, something is shifting, and we must push back. I am very excited to talk to Yenmi Park today. She's just 27 years old. When she was born in North Korea, and she escaped there when she was 13. Her story is amazing. She is so brave and so powerful. And, you know, what do they say? Big things can come in small packages. I'll tell you more about that on the other side of our conversation. She escaped from North Korea with her mother in 2013, was sold into sex slavery in China, was there for a year, ultimately was able to get out of that situation and escape yet again to South Korea. And then her life really took off. Became an amazing student and ultimately matriculated at Columbia University, where she found out that the faculty, the staff there, had a lot in common with the North Korean government. Yes, a totalitarian regime. It was very reminiscent there at Columbia University. So her book, by the way, In Order to Live, A North Korean Girl's Journey to Freedom, is available wherever books are sold. It's been out for a couple of years now, but she's receiving a new wave of attention because, well, her observations about what's happening at Columbia University, and also the fact that we are becoming, it seems, like an authoritarian state, and she has a lot to say about the dangers of that. That conversation in just moments, but first, someone else who's with us in pushing back against censorship, against authoritarianism, against woke culture, the good people, the great people at Freedom Fatigues. Have you noticed how many people are unpatriotic these days? I mean, the flag is somehow triggering them, which is total nonsense, completely outrageous. We have to fight back. And one way you can is by wearing these great clothes from a great American-made, veteran-owned company. It's called Freedom Fatigues, and they have everything from hoodies to t-shirts and hats with awesome pro-American graphics and slogans, all made right here in the USA. You'll feel proud every time you put a Freedom Fatigues item on. I certainly do. Check out their incredible designs at freedomfatigues.com. That's freedom, you know how to spell that, fatigues. You don't spell that as often, so it's F-A-T-I-G-U-E-S, freedomfatigues.com. And if you enter the promo code GK20, you will get a 20% off discount when you check out, all right? So stand up to the woke madness that's plaguing our country and do something great for a beautiful American company. Wear Freedom Fatigues. And now my conversation with a young, brave, very impressive Yen-Mi Park. All of the wonderful things that we have here in America and in the West, things like, you know, access to the internet whenever we want, beautiful mm-hmm. cell phones. We can watch anything at any time. We can buy so many things. Number one, does that still seem new to you, or has that worn off?
Not at all. I mean, like I was last night. I went out, and then I hung over this morning, and I was like, I feel like I want to eat some broth, and you know. In North Korea, I mean, that's unimaginable, right? And then I ordered this Vietnamese pho, and that delivered to my door. Pushing some few buttons, someone makes you this pho to you, a Vietnamese food, not even American food in America. And that's the other thing. This is the beauty of living in capitalism. How can you ever, ever imagine something like that living in socialism? That just never happens. And that's why I was so grateful there's somebody who delivers and there's somebody in the kitchen cook for me. And this is just marvelous. I don't even know if this is not miracle, if this is not paradise, what else can be?
I'm sorry, did you say you woke up with a hangover?
I woke up with a hangover. My stomach was very hurt. So I was like, I want to eat some soup, right? Like some broth. And I thought, okay, maybe Vietnamese pho would do it. And then all you have to do is like going on the phone and press some few buttons and that's it. Not even pressing buttons, and tap some few things and then somebody makes the food and deliver it to your door in the morning.
It's amazing. May I ask about last night? Sounds like a great night. What happened?
No. Also, yeah, last night too, there was a place where there was beautiful music, where people are free to dance and drink. And, you know, living in North Korea, like, regime tell you what music to listen to, what kind of dance to do. Regime decides everything for you. But, and that's what one thing that also shocked me is that when I was in South Korea, people gave me this gift as something called planners. You know, there's a notebook that mm-hmm. is like planner. And it's like, what is a planner? And they said, oh, it's like the things that you want to plan, like what you want to do this year and this month and this today. This is what you write down. But as a North Korean, we never allowed to plan our days ever. Like literally the government people come to you in the morning. They say, where are we going to go work collectively this morning? And when we're going to eat breakfast? When we're going to eat lunch, when we're going to finish work, everything ordered by the regime. We do not have authority to plan our days ever. So it was such a new concept for me that you can plan your days.
That is amazing.
And yeah. It's unbelievable to me that humans can live this way, in this free way.
Now, have you been here long enough to see some of the downsides of having all of these choices? I'm not saying I don't want all these choices. I love our way of life. I love the access. I want the access we have to anything at any time. But as you know, and you probably have friends, those things don't necessarily, you called it paradise, but you know, let's face it, there's more to life and you can be miserable even surrounded by all of these material things and options. Have you noticed, I mean, for instance, most of us take these things for granted. You don't, and that's special. Do you see the danger, potentially, of having too much?
Well, like people say, oh, America is the place of abundance. And then they say as if something is a negative thing, right? There, but the thing is, in America, you have freedom to not to have anything if you do not want it. That's the thing. You can become a minimalist. You can donate everything. You can own nothing. So having too much is not a problem ever. To me, is that having not having a choice to own things, that's a problem. So the thing is, like, the problem that I see in America is not that there's a is a problem, is there's abundance in it. It's the problem is people becoming spoiled. And I'm so sorry to say that, but especially these young millennials that I see are so spoiled. They're complaining about having too much. Like, they are to the point, right? Everything is complaining. America loves complaining. I'm so sorry, but it is fascinating why people having this much and they love to complain. So that is, I think, what is sad about this country, is that people are not grateful and they do not the values of what they have. And how unique the situation they have is, like, this literally is the best time to be alive as a human being, being in America. It is like, you know, our ancestors have dreamed of, and the world is dreaming of living like Americans too, right?
Yeah.
And still they somehow manage to find problems and complain about it. That's also another miracle to me.
I want to go back to the early days, but before I do, you do see, however, right now, and you're quite frankly, this is one of the reasons why you're famous. We are at a moment here in America where freedom seems to be in jeopardy.
Yeah,
it's absolutely a far cry from what's happening in North Korea. But in your own words, how precarious a time is this? How some of it might be, is it hyped by the media, or is there a genuine assault on our freedoms of speech, thought, everything?
So why do authoritarians, they control speech? Is that humans are very unique. We think by talking. That's why people go to therapists, right? They to solve problems, they have to talk about it. So if you stop someone speaking, that means they're going to stop thinking as well. And if people stop thinking, then it's very easy to control people, right? They don't think anymore. So the assault on freedom of speech in America is not definitely, it's not some hype from media. It's not a, you know, conspiracy theory. This country is going into a direction where it's unimaginable direction that I don't even put into words, because how even Nazi Germany began, like how the Holocaust began, right? They took one step to get there, one by one, little steps. And then it led to Nazi Germany, North Korean regime too. They first saying, okay, let's communism, let's get rid of the, you know, private property. And then they go after people, okay, if your ancestor fall in the wrong side of the world, let's kill them. And then the next thing is, if say somebody say this, let's kill them too. That's how they one by one they're going. And in America right now, if you, I mean, call somebody mispronounce, you're a bigot. And there is like a hate speech code in corporations, in Ivy League schools, in education places. So many things that come up right now. And even I am getting censored on YouTube and Twitter. Can you, I mean, this country goes after former president and canceling, and there's nobody is safe in this country right now. Like, that's the thing. That is to the point they are even going after the former president. And this is okay with the most of Americans. And that's what scares me, is that when I came out of North Korea, people were telling me, you know, our North Koreans are dumb or something. Why would they not rise? Why do they not have a revolution? And now I'm in America. You get canceled on social media. You get canceled on TV. You lose your jobs if you have not politically correct ideas. But why are you guys not rising up? Because the consequences of rising up in America is maximum losing your jobs. Right? Losing your livelihood. But in North Korea, it kills 3 generations of your life, your family. So even this little fear is enough to make people to confirm and silence. So that's how little it takes to silence people. And that's what is so scary, how people are so scared, and that little fear is so effective to control people's minds.
Amazing. Yes, indeed. That's where we are. And to hear you speak about it, make the comparisons very, very powerful. What year were you born?
I was at the end of 1993.
When is your birthday?
So, October.
And I understand you have an older sister. What's the age gap?
No, she was about 2 to 3 years older than me.
And your parents, when you were born, how old were they?
They were, when I was born, I think my mom was around 27. And I think my mom had my sister maybe around 24, I think so. And my father was, just 30, maybe 31.
And they were married, right? There's.
Oh, yeah, they were married, yes.
And
there's...
No, just because, well, you mentioned, I heard you say once that in North Korea, there's no word for romantic love. The only word for love is about the leadership.
Yeah.
So, like, how did they meet if there's no idea of romantic love, like, how did your mom and dad come together, and how does that work in North Korea? Are they assigned spouses?
You do have assigned spouses from the party. Yeah, you do have us. And then for the commoners, right, North Korea, even though Sorcerer's Paradise, they have a class system. It's the biggest caste system you can imagine. They have three big categories of different castes. And they say bottom one is hostile, middle one is wavering, and then the top called the core class. Among those big three categories, there's like subdivided into 50 different classes. And this is like a national sensitive information. You don't really know which exactly category you belong to. Only the party knows it. And that's how they determine where you live, what ration you get, where you go to school, what you do. I mean, there's no such a thing when you go to university in North Korea. Government tell you who can go. And if you go, they tell you major. And then they tell you, you become an athlete, you become a musician, you become a farmer. Nobody chooses their path. Right, so yeah, even going to South Korea, they were like, what do you want to do? And I was like, do I need to know what I do with my life? Right, can you just tell me what to do? And in North Korea, literally, regime says everything, and including marriage, like that they assign your partner, because the purpose of marriage in North Korea is creating revolutionaries by giving birth and then fight for the revolution of the party. That is the purpose of marriage, not loving the partner. Therefore, by commoners, they usually get arranged marriages through family and friends. And parents decide, you know, who their child should marry. It's not, it's changing really recently, but most of them still are very heavily relied on arranged marriage through family.
What class were you in? You say there are three. And which one were you in?
I was, when I was born, somewhere in the wavering, in the middle. However, my father was sent to prison camp for engaging in the market. And in socialism, trading is illegal, right? You have to government decide what to produce, who gets what. But the regime decided not to feed us. They just like, okay, we are not going to feed the people, and they will not give us food. And that is the most messed up thing about this socialism, is that government decides who should be fed. And once they stop the public ration, what do North Koreans do? They cannot even trade. They don't have freedom. So millions have died in the 90s when I was born. It's called the Arduous March. Like more than 3 million people died between 1995 to 1998 when I was like 3 to 6 years old. And yeah, so
Sorry to interrupt, but I want to find out, did your mom and dad, how did they come together? Mm-hmm. Was it arranged
through
or was
family.
It through
yes.
family, through family?
Yes,
and,
yeah,
but they
it
were,
was through their parents.
But they were both in the middle class. And did you say the classes are divided into 50 subgroups? Was it 50 or 15? 15.
50.
and nobody has an idea what they belong to.
Oh, no, no, we do know. We are vaguely somewhere in the middle or the bottom. But you know, the another thing that regime does to prevent mixing the different classes, that there's no marrying up in North Korea. There's only marrying down. So if the woman is from the low family and guy is from the top family, when you marry, that guy's family going down with the woman. You don't go up. There's no such a thing going up. So that's how they...
Mm-hmm. No, sorry. I understand. Only marrying, you can only, if you're the guy, you're going down, and a woman can't marry up.
Yeah, or men cannot marry up either. They are lower, and the women is top in the class, and then when they marry, the women going down with the guy.
When you're walking around, number one, how did your parents get along? Was it a loving relationship, even though the word was somewhat illegal or misunderstood? What was your home life like with your family?
I mean, they were, of course, we did not know what love was, but they were very attentive and caring, you know, really loving parents. They loved each other in their own ways. But in North Korea, like, there's no such a thing like human rights, not to mention even women's rights. So daily basis, like our neighbors, you know, men hit their wives a lot. And of course, like there was, my father would do this, not as often, but still would do that. But you know, in North Korea, there's a saying that if you want to train the dog and the wife, you gotta beat them. And that's how backwards they are when it comes to human rights. They really do not even know anything, because the regime never teaches. Like, imagine that regime teaches them human rights, but they torture the North Koreans every single day and execute them. How they can let the people know how to treat each other, because they treat us so horribly. So people don't know really how to treat humans there, unfortunately.
Your father, I saw in a talk you acknowledged your mother and your sister were watching from South Korea online. Forgive me, but what happened to your father?
Oh, he passed away in China. He was sent to labor camp, and then he got out sick. And in China, he passed away from a disease that he got in the jail.
So growing up in North Korea, you've been quite clear. You don't know how bad you have it. You're isolated. You don't even have the equipment intellectually to compare yourself or judge much of anything. This is the world, and this is the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. The people talk about here, you know, oppression, right? They say we are systemically oppressed, and I was telling them, like, the fact that you know you're oppressed, you are not oppressed. The people who are actually oppressed do not even know they're oppressed. I mean, they don't even know the definition of oppression and talk about oppression. I mean, people in North Korea, they don't know they are slaves. And, you know, if you do not know you're a slave, how do you fight to be free? You can't.
What was North Korea doing differently in that there have been other totalitarian societies, but they were more connected to the rest of the world somehow? I mean, North Korea, they seem to have been more effective than, say, the former Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, of countries before the fall of communism. I mean, they, and certainly China. I mean, because everyone else was able to, whether it were radio-free Europe, or they were getting some semblance of the outside world. Why is North Korea, or how is North Korea better at keeping outside influences away? What were the other countries not doing that North Korea does? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Why is that? Is because no regime has been more evil than North Korean regime has. You know, South Africa had Nelson Mandela. How can Nelson Mandela exist in North Korea? They're gonna kill up to 8 generations of people who revolt. And also they were so obsessed controlling, right? You, as a journalist, nobody can go into North Korea and cover North Korea without government watch. So it became, the country became a prison. It's the biggest prison camp in the world. Entire border is sealed with wire fences and electrified wire fences. Not only that, Kim Jong-un was, like, sealing the border, he was burying landmines in those wire fences and then putting a machine gun on it. So anybody who crossed the border, they shoot them killed. So this kind of zero tolerance made North Korea to become like this. And I think a lot of countries, even Soviets or even East Germany, Venezuela, Cuba, I mean, the fact is still know what protest is. I mean, in North Korea, we don't even know protest. We don't have those vocabularies like in our addiction. And why George Orwell talks about who controls the language, who controls the thoughts, right? If you don't have a word like revolution, if you don't have a word of love, you don't have a word of human rights, freedom. Humans don't know this, right? Somebody came up with it. Like when we're born, of course, we don't know what justice is and what is not justice. All of these things are being taught to us. And democracy is a convention. It's like humanity began as a, you know, with democracy. So all this knowledge that we think somehow humans inherently know, we don't. And in North Korean people, that's why they don't know about this. Because they've been served from the, you know, the history is forgotten to North Korean. They don't even teach us anything about how humans came about. You know, we don't really know what happened before Kim's. I never heard like Shakespeare, you know, I never heard like none of those people.
Did you ever hear of a guy named Jim or John Dresnok, James Joseph Dresnok? Does that ring a bell? He's an American mm-hmm. who defected to North Korea in the 1960s, oh, yeah. And he became somewhat, I believe he became famous in North Korea. Do you know anything about him?
He cannot be famous in North Korea because they will not promote Americans to be famous. I do remember seeing him in the movies playing American Bastard's character.
But he wasn't famous?
But no, in North Korea, there's no such a thing an individual becomes famous. We don't even know the actors' names, right? Because, I mean, we don't have internet, so how do you go look up about the individuals, you know? Only thing that we know memorize the Kim Il-sung, the Kim's revolution history, their birthdays, and there's no such a thing called the fans. And when I'm in South Korea, like, I am a fan of this. So, like, what does it mean, fan? And it's like, oh, maybe follower, admirer. Like, I couldn't get that concept for a while because in North Korea, you are never allowed to adore or even like other than the party and the dear leader. So nobody's famous in North Korea other than Kim.
But you were looking at movies. You were looking at North Korean content or what would you, I guess my second question is, mm-hmm. what was recreation like if there was any recreation? But tell me a little bit about the movies that you did see, when you saw them, how you saw them, what they were about.
So North Korea does not have 24 hours of electricity. So in order to finish a movie, it takes months to finish one movie. Because like sometimes electricity comes in the summer and where there's more water in the dam, it comes like 30 minutes or maybe like 15 minutes, 5 minutes, and it goes and off. So it's very hard to watch something, even the national TV. And there's only one channel on TV. And that starts at like in the afternoon for 3 hours. So it's all about propaganda. So people invented ways of getting us information through Chinese border. So one of the movies that I remember watching illegally, I mean, this is like watching a foreign information actually can kill you in North Korea. If you read the Bible, you get executed. If you watch porn, you get executed. If you disagree like Hollywood movies, you get executed. If you watch K-pop, I mean, you send prison camps and like really many years. But despite that, North Koreans are curious about the war. They are risking their lives to watch foreign information. And one of the movies that I watched was Titanic. And back then I was like, why a man dying for a woman, right? That just didn't compute to me. Like, that was just, love is such a shameful thing. I was really worried that, like, the director and DiCaprio, everybody in the movie got killed for making such a shameful movie. And I did not know that love was something adored in the rest of the world, you know? That was something shameful thing, and I couldn't believe why anybody does that. And it took a while for me to understand, and it really, that was, I think, the first time I felt some humanity and freedom while watching Titanic.
you were confused by it, but you enjoyed it. Did you
in
like the movie?
I was very confused because I still remember this scene where the boat sinks and all these plates falling down and breaks, right? I was like, I've never seen that many plates in my life.
Oh.
And they were like eating so much food. And I was like, that seems like a long time ago. But even then, people had more food than we have now, you know.
Did you ever see, that's incredible. I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
No.
Did you ever see, two things. Would you see airplanes or helicopters flying around, either military or anything? Was that routine?
Not a routine, but if that happens, oh my God, that's the happiest day. All the children go outside and scream. So there was a time, I don't remember ever seeing an airplane, but I do remember seeing helicopter. Then everybody screams, all the kids look at, like, because really not much going on in North Korea. Their life is like living in the 16th century in the Middle Ages where there's no electricity, no heater. We go to river. We don't even know what shower is. We just go to river and wash it in the summer. In the winter, we don't even take a bath. If we do, maybe once before the New Year's Eve. And, you know, like, we don't know what shampoo or conditioner is. Like, we make our own soap, but it's very bad. It hurts your skin, right? So if there's something flying in the sky, not often, I think maybe once maximum I have seen it. Or maybe I heard a story, some of my friends seen it, something flying in the sky.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe, like, how that thing is possible. I did not know even what airplane was. I heard about airplanes. I made airplanes with my paper, right? But it wasn't airplane that I've ever seen the picture of it, so I do not know how airplane looked like.
Yeah, it's incredible. So, and going to school, well, number one, I should get this out of the way. Starvation, going without food is a fact of life for you frequently, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is a, starvation became a tool for the vision. And, you know, right, like when humans are hungry, only thing that we're worrying about is food. Why would Kim Jong-un do that? Why didn't he not want to feed his own people? Is that so? Now I eat breakfast as a North Korean. Do you know what I'm gonna worry about? Is how am I gonna find my lunch? If you find lunch, then I go, how am I gonna make it to dinner? Once you make that day, okay, I made it one day on earth. How am I gonna find out to survive tomorrow? So your brain is constantly occupied by surviving. How do I find food? But if you are fed, right, you're going to thinking about the meaning of life, how to improve your life, what's your hobby. You keep expanding your thoughts around it. So it's so simple. When population starves on the starvation mode, all they are thinking is looking for food. They are not thinking about throwing off the regime. They're not thinking about doing anything other than surviving.
And that's deliberate. That's deliberate. That's not, I mean, the perception is that, the communism is so screwed up that they can't have enough food. They can't make enough food.
No.
That's not true. This is an actual weapon.
It's a man-made famine. So North Korea, since 2017, they conducted above like 37 missile tests. Last 4 years. Each missile test costs the money that is enough to feed the entire 25 million of people in entire year. So if he just didn't do 4 tests out of 37 tests, entire North Koreans could have been fed and not starving. It's not like we're asking him to even not even doing a test, right?
Sure.
If he just did like 1% less of a test, entire people can be fed. And this time, what was shocking is that even America, Biden was begging to give North Korea vaccines. And the European countries, the World Health Organization, they are begging to give the vaccine to North Korea regime. And they said, no, thank you. Because, I mean, the pandemic is an amazing tool for him. And with this fear, like you might die, don't come out of your home, stay at home for as long as you can. Like, why would he want to give that up? So he said, no, thank you to vaccines. He does not want this thing to go away.
How much would you say North Korea's problems are inflicted by the Western world, other countries? You know, there are sanctions in effect. There are all kinds of embargoes, all kinds of things I think that won't be imported. How much blamed you personally, if blame maybe is the wrong word, but if there were free and open, well, do you think North Korea in any way has been punished by the West?
No, not at all. I mean, Nurse Kim Jong-un likes the isolation, right? And that when people, especially people on the left, they hate this sort of sanctions. So like they always try to blame the West and America for every single problem that exists in this world. And it's the same thing in North Korea. It's America screwed Cuba. America screwed Venezuela. America screwed North Korea. And it's the same. Another thing is that that's the biggest misconception. We do. America wants to, I mean, the UN organization still wants to give food to North Korea. And North Korea is the one saying no thank you to medical aid, to food programs. Do you know, like, the world is begging North Korean region, like, can we please give you food? Can we please give you, like, medicine so your people don't die? And they say, no, don't you send us. We don't want it. So even, like, last year, North Korea hit by a huge flood. South Korean president is begging to Kim Jong-un, can we please send you some aid? And Kim Jong-un said no. Because Kim Jong-un doesn't want those aids that is helping the people. Sanction is, you have to read what sanction is. Sanction is preventing Kim Jong-un to sell weapons and buy luxury goods like Chanel bags, like cognac, boat, like the things that is not helping the people, but they're helping the royal family. And sanction lists are the people who conduct business for the regime, who sell drugs, who sells weapons, and doing money laundering for the regime. Those people are sanctioned. If sanction doesn't affect when the world wants to give money, I mean, the food and formula to the children and the medical aid to North Korea. But those are ones where Kim Jong-un turns down.
Should you be worried? Should you be worried? Yeah. About your own safety? Are you worried about your own safety? You are a very vocal critic against the North Korean regime. And mm-hmm. for us, that's great in the West, and we want to know. But for you personally, I mean, we know that Kim Jong-un has assassinated or had assassinated people, relatives, mm-hmm. you know, in foreign countries and that kind of thing. And Putin is doing it to people he doesn't like. Is this something that you should be concerned about? Are you concerned about it? What are your thoughts?
I mean, obviously, like, I was warned by South Korean intelligence long time ago, constantly. They told me that I'm on the killing list of Kim Jong-un. So, I mean, that was even way before that I spoke a lot louder now. But back then, even when I was remotely close to speaking out, that's already I was there. And then Kim Jong-un made three generations of my family who I left behind, including my neighbors, and then put them on the national TV, and you can find them on YouTube, actually, on North Korean propaganda channel on YouTube exists, right? Talking about fake news. They don't go after those fake news, but they like go after people like me on YouTube. They denounce me that I'm the puppet of the propaganda, the West, and I'm a CIA spy. And of course, I'm the anti-socialist, you know, this enemy of the people. So North Koreans know about me. They had a huge national lecture around about me to how people need to hate me, that I'm their enemy. Now, I mean, even we know Jamal Khashoggi, right? He eventually he's following on Twitter that killed him. He had a huge platform.
I'm sorry, general, which general?
No, Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
Remember?
Yes, Khashoggi for the Washington Post and in Turkey,
yeah.
Right.
Right, I mean, like that, but even he got chopped off in the Turkey, I mean, in Saudi consulate. There's really no consequences for killing a dissident, really. I mean, when Kim Jong-un killed his half-brother in Malaysian airport, so Kim Jong-nam, like 3 years ago, nothing happened. So, yeah, I know that there's no consequences for Kim Jong-un to kill me at all. Nothing going to happen. Like, there are some news coverage, but that's going to be it. People going to forget about it. Nothing going to happen. There's no consequences for dictators killing dissent. And that's why I'm fighting. Like, I know that my life is threat, so I definitely do not take my days granted, you know. Because also, like, my enemy is a nation. It's a dictatorship that has nukes, right? It's not some psychopath is like trying to kill me. If Kim Jong-un wants to kill me, He got resources, he got money, he got people. He has agents even in America. He can kill me anytime he wants. So it's almost not up for me to worry about it. He's like, if he's gonna think I need to be dead right now, I will be dead. So in a way, it's liberating too. When your enemy is so big like that, it's rationally, it just makes no sense worrying about it anymore.
I understand.
In the
beginning,
yeah, and in the beginning, 3 years, I think I was worried. But now at this point, I am surrendered.
So let's talk a little bit about, I know your family is drawn to the lights of China, or you're wondering about them and you see them all the time. I also heard you speak once about if you were in a burning building and you were about to die, you would jump out. And that just spoke to me. And that's kind of what you did with your family. You left without much of a plan. But two things, how long prior to leaving North Korea were you talking about it? Were you thinking about it with your family?
Talking about our experience from North Korea?
I mean, no, getting out.
Can you rephrase that question for me? That question?
Yeah, sure. So you left, when did you leave North Korea?
I escaped in 2007.
And who went with you?
My mom. It was my decision to go with her. And I told her, like, come with me to China, because my sister escaped a few days before me. And I got sick. I couldn't go with her. But a few days later, I found a note that my sister left for me to find. And she said, oh, go to find this lady and she will help you. So I went with my mom and I told my mom to let's go to China together. And we decided to escape exact the same day without even telling our father.
But he was without telling your dad.
Because in North Korea, even saying a goodbye is a luxury. So if we go on the way and then get caught, and if my father knew that we were going, he would be in trouble for letting that happen. He's going to be punished severely. So if he did not know that you're going and then we get caught and then he did not know, then he might not be as much punished.
Was there a moment that said, okay, your sister left, but were you planning on it? I understand you didn't have planning as an option. It wasn't really something you did much, but how actively were you thinking about leaving, or did you just decide spur of the moment? Did your sisters decide, you know what, I'm leaving tonight? Or was it like, I'm going to leave next month, or I'm going to leave next year? Were you talking about it in that sense?
It was more like I started it. I was at the end of when I was 12 years old, life was becoming unbearable. It was very hard to find food, right? We were barely surviving. And then when I was like 13, I remembered, like, that's when I really thought, okay, I might be just die like the children on the streets like that. And then looking across the river, there were lights coming from China. And I somehow felt if I go where the lights were, then I might find some food. So I initially talked to my, I think, sister or my mom together. Like, I want to go see there and then look for food over there. And initially my father was like, that's crazy. But he couldn't even say no, because he couldn't feed us. We didn't have food. And my mom too, like, if we would not go, we were dying anyway. He wasn't like, we were giving up anything by leaving North Korea. Nothing we had there going on for us, right? So, and then my sister and I was trying to find people to help us to go. And then in the middle of that process, I got sick, and my sister found the person to stand there while I was sick. That's why she couldn't wait. She left me a note. Initially, I was going to go with my own sister, and my parents would stay. And we had no clue what China was. I mean, in that bright light, that fancy country that I looked over China from North Korea, I had no clue that there was such a dark world that was waiting for us. I had no clue.
So how did you get across that river?
It was frozen river in 2007, at the end of March, I think March 26th, I still remember. There were there are people, brokers who bribe the guards, right? There's guards with machine guns who shoot, so we cannot just cross it. They had to bribe the guards and then told them that we are carriers. So we are about snow or something from China, and then we're the workers. So we're going to go and then come back with the stuff, because I don't think guards would send us if they know that we are not coming back. So told them, oh, we're there and then go carry some stuff and come back. And then they did let us go. So we crossed the frozen river, and that's how we escaped North Korea.
Did you say the guards were bribed?
The guards were bribed by the brokers.
Like, and what does it take to bribe them? Like, what and what did you have? I guess you had to give. Did you have to come up with it?
No. The brokers. I mean, we had nothing to give. The brokers did.
Did the brokers need something from you though?
Mm-hmm. But then, no, brokers were selling us to human traffickers. That's why they did not need anything.
Oh, I see. So that was part of the arrangement. You're going to China, but did you know the human trafficking part about all of this?
No. I didn't even know what trafficking was. Like, how do I know human trafficking? Because in North Korea, news are always about great things. I never even heard about rape. So I never knew what kind of crimes was happening in the world. I never heard of such a thing. So going there, not even questioning why these people are helping us. But they were helping us because they were selling us to Chinese men as sex slaves.
And you walk across that river, and what happens? Does it happen right away? I mean, are you just thrown into that life immediately? What happens next?
I'm sorry. Once
you cross the river, basically, what happens then?
So we cross the river with my mom, and then the first thing is I want to have sex with her and the guy, and then I don't even know what sex is. Like, there is no sex education in North Korea, and people are not even allowed to hold hands in public. We don't know what sex is as a child. And I was very confused, and I was like only like something 50, around 50 pounds, really small. And my mom offered herself instead. And then after that, they took us to this house. And then we were like slaves. They were making us turn around and negotiating our place price with other broker. And they sold my mom for, I think, around $65 in 2007. And I was sold for over $200. And I was more expensive because I was virgin and somehow a child, right? That's valuable in China. So that's how they sold me and separated my mom and myself from each other. And we were sold separately to human traffickers.
And you were raped immediately. Is that what you said? Forgive me, but you were...
No, I was the second trafficker who got... The first trafficker, my mom protected me. The second trafficker who got was trying to rape me, and I was going to kill myself. And then that's when he said, oh, if you become my mistress, and then I can help you to save your family. So he made an offer to me, like, I'm going to bring your, buy, because he was the one who sold my mom too. So I'm going to buy your mom back from a farmer that I sold, and then bring your father, and then help you to look for your sister. So that's, I became his mistress, and of course he raped me. So,
and how old were you again? 13?
I was 13. So that's how I found my mom back several months later. The broker who I made a deal with, he bought my mom back from a farmer that he sold. And then he brought my sick father from North Korea. And that's how my father passed away in China, right before Beijing Olympic in 2008.
This man, I guess he made good on his part of the deal, as hideous and crazy as all this is. How do you feel about him? I'm sorry, but did you become friends? Did you become, I mean, it's impossible. I guess it could happen though, but, what was that like? Did you?
I think exactly. That experience really taught me that nobody is pure evil. Like, nothing is black and white in life, right? He was evil. I mean, he was raping 13 years old. His daughter was like 1 year younger than me. And I mean, as a father, like, who has a daughter, I don't know how he could have done that. But the thing is, he also was a human with humanity in him. And he loved me in his own ways. So he saved me, helped me to find my mom back and get my father to North Korea. And that's why. But the thing is, when I was reading him, you know, I also, back then I was so young to even understand the complexity of being a human. And I did hate him so many times. I wanted to kill him and murder him. But then, also, you know, grateful. So, you know, it's a complex experience. Now I have no hatred towards him, nothing resentful. I am grateful for what he has done for me, which is saving my family. And yeah, so all I have now is just gratitude, nothing else left there.
And how long are you there? How long are you in that arrangement?
Over a year. And after over a year, I found a way, which was through North Korea, another defector told me there was a way to go to South Korea and be free. And then in order to do that, you gotta go become Christians for missionaries. Because there were missionaries from South Korea or West North Koreans. If we become Christians, they would save us, right? So I went to their shelter, Christian shelter in China, studied the Bible, and taught that, I mean, proved that my faith towards God. And then once that faith was proven to them, they told us how to go to South Korea, which means just crossing, walking across the frozen Gobi Desert in the Mongolia from China. We do a compass in your hand. So we got a compass in 2009. By then, it was 2 years later after in China. In 2009, it was freezing cold in February. I mean, it's like minus 40 degrees in desert. We had a few people in our team from the missionaries groups. We walked across the desert to Mongolia. Then we got rescued by Mongolian soldiers. And several months later, I went to South Korea.
A couple of quick things. When you left, when you escaped to the missions and you studied the Bible, just before that, mm-hmm. was your father and your mother and your sister, were they all there with that man, with the man who bought you? Were they all there?
Yes. My father passed away, but my mom, not with the man who bought. The man who bought me, after over a year, as I said, he loved me his own way. He was letting me go.
He let you go?
Yeah. He did let me go to be free. And then what I heard is that after we arrived in South Korea, he got caught by Chinese the police, and he was sent to prison for 10 years. And he got out, I think, last year from the prison. And I thanked him for saving my family, and that's how everything now became okay.
So, all right. Now, when you go to the missions and they say, if you're a Christian, mm-hmm. we can do this, and you start reading the Bible, and you said you proved your faith to them, were you a genuine believer? Did you become a Christian, or is it something that you would, and it would be understandable, you know, you would say anything to get out of that situation, but were you genuine in your faith, or was it something that you were pretending to be?
So the thing is, I mean, I was in China, scared to death to get caught by Chinese police, right? So it was irony that in the beginning, I couldn't believe there's such a thing called a God that you cannot even see. There was somebody came many, many thousands of years ago called Jesus, and then who can do miracles. And it was exactly like North Korean regime, because they copied the Bible. North Korea is the number one Christian persecution country. It's because when people know about Christianity, it is exactly Kim's. Kim says, I love you so much that I gave you my son, Kim Jong-il, and then he died for you, but his spirit is with us forever. Therefore, he knows what I think in my head and how, what kind of miracles he can do. It's like all mythical thing that he copied from Bible. And then I was thinking, why? I just got out of North Korea. Why do I have to keep believing in something to survive? It was very ironic in the beginning. And then the lady, I remember in the church, said, like, don't worry, babe, you just plug God into Kim Il-sung and plug Jesus into, you know, Kim Jong-il. And everything made full sense to me, how the Bible works. But the thing is, I was so desperate. Like, you know, in that desperate situation, if somebody asked you to believe in rock, you would believe in rock. I wasn't faking it. I think I was so desperate that I would believe in anything that would save me. I think that's how strong human will is to survive. And yeah, I remember in the middle of desert, I was so cold. I was chased by Chinese soldiers. It was freezing and so hard. I was praying for everything in this world, praying for God, praying for sky, rocks, air, whatever thing that will save you, and praying for Buddha, whatever thing saves you, you pray. That's the thing. It's so interesting when in the face of death, first thing that humans do is pray. And so, yeah, I mean, when I was in the shelter, I think I was a believer. I wasn't lying about it. And after going to South Korea, that's when I was able to think critically and then, you know, analyzing it. But back then, I think I was Christian. Yeah.
So you get to South Korea after this long journey. And I'm sorry, how long did it take? 7 months?
No. I was in Mongolia for several months. I think 3 months, maybe 3 to 4 months.
And then you're in South Korea. Who are you with? What happens next? You start going to school, right?
Yeah. So I arrived there as a teenager, and then, you know, finding freedom for the first time.
Oh, wait. Sorry. One more thing. Before we get to that, can you just tell me that year that you're a captive, you're a slave to this guy, essentially. Are you watching TV? Are you, do you have the internet? Are you learning things? Or is it just a, you know, a situation where you're his concubine, forgive me, and that's it? Or are you learning? Are you experiencing some of the world during that 1 year?
In South Korea?
No, in China, when you were sold to that man.
No. I mean, there was, like, I did not know internet. After I got out from him, I went into working in this thing called chat room, where you chat with the men, and that's how you make money. But then that's way better than prostitution, because nobody actually touching you.
Yeah.
So I did that, but then I still did not know that internet could help me to search things or other things. I did not know how internet worked. I did not even know how to turn the computer or turn off the computer, right? The modern technology was so new, so I did not know. When I went to South Korea, I learned there's a search web that where you can search stuff and look things up. And that was, it was a new world. I think all my, those like, my interaction with the modern these conventions was all in South Korea.
All right. So South Korea, you become acquainted with the world and you start going to school. Who are you living with? What's the life like?
I couldn't go to school because in South Korean age, I was 17 years old. And then, and even American age, I'm like 15, but South Korea has different calculation when it comes to age. They took me a lever test. Placement test, and then my place education level came out as like a first grade in elementary school because I never seen the map of the world. I can barely do the like addition, and I don't even know what Africa or Canada is. I have no clue what the world is. So they told me to go study with like 7-6 years old, and I was not gonna do that right at 17. So I taught myself. I took GED, so I crashed like 12 years education into 1 year by teaching myself. And I had roommates, and sometimes I lived alone. And, you know, I was in Seoul in the capital studying. Afterwards, I went into university very quickly after I arrived in South Korea.
All right, me and my questions about details and okay, what happened then? And go back and I'm sorry. So we had an hour, and we didn't get to the part about her experience at Columbia University. That's how she first came to my attention. So I'm going to read a write-up from earlier this month. Actually, it's last month in the New York Post. She was also on my Newsmax show. You can find that on YouTube. But let me go through this with you. A North Korean defector said she viewed the U.S. as a country of free thought and free speech until she went to college here. Yeonmi Park attended Columbia University and was immediately struck by what she viewed as anti-Western sentiment in the classroom and a focus on political correctness that had her thinking, even North Korea isn't this nuts. I expected that I was paying this fortune all this time and energy to learn how to think, but they are forcing you to think the way you want to think, Park said. I realized, wow, this is insane. I thought America was different, but I saw so many similarities to what I saw in North Korea that I started worrying. The 27-year-old told the Post that she couldn't believe she would be asked to do this much censoring of myself at a university in the United States. I literally crossed the Gobi Desert to be free, and I realized I'm not free. America's not free. Yeonmi Park fled North Korea at age 13 in 2007, a voyage that took her and her family to China and South Korea before she went to school in New York in 2016. Her professors gave students trigger warnings, sharing the wording from readings in advance so people could opt out of reading or even sitting in class during discussions, Park told the Post. Going to Columbia, the first thing I learned was safe space, she said. Every problem, they explained, is because of white men. Some of the discussions of white privilege reminded her of the caste system in her native country, where people are categorized based on their ancestors, she said. In one class, a teacher discussing Western civilization asked students if they had a problem with the name of the topic. Most students raised their hands, according to Park. Some, she said, mentioned issues with the colonial slant of the discussion. And classes often began with professors asking students for their preferred pronouns, with the use of they becoming scary as she feared being socially penalized for not being inclusive enough in her vocabulary. English is my third language, she said. It's very hard for me to say he and she sometimes. I misuse them. Isn't that amazing? Wow. She told Fox that she was chided for saying she enjoyed the writings of Jane Austen. I said, I love those books. I thought it was a good thing, Park told the outlet. Then she said, did you know those writers had a colonial mindset? They were racists and bigots and subconsciously brainwashing you. Park said North Korea students were constantly informed about the American bastard. I thought North Koreans were the only people who hated Americans, but turns out there are a lot of people hating this country in this country, she told the Post. Cancel culture and shouting down opposing voices is becoming an issue of self-censorship. Park, who chronicled her escape from North Korea and life in the repressive regime in the 2015 memoir, In Order to Live, said Americans seem willing to give their rights away, not realizing they may never come back. Voluntarily, these people are censoring each other, silencing each other. No force behind it, she said. Other times in history, there's a military coup d'etat, like a force comes in, taking your rights away and silencing you. But this country is choosing to be silenced, choosing to give their rights away. Park said she knows what a country could become with rights and discourse stripped away. North Korea was pretty insane, she said. Like the first thing my mom taught me was, don't even whisper. The birds and mice could hear me. She told me the most dangerous thing that I had in my body was my tongue, Park said. So I knew how dangerous it was to say wrong things in a country. Park, who grew up in the last Stalinist dictatorship and witnessed people dying from starvation, said Americans are obsessed with oppression, even though there is not much oppression they've witnessed firsthand. This is completely nuts. This is unbelievable, she said. I don't know why people are collectively going crazy like this or together at the same time. She said the situation in North Korea is one thing because the people don't have access to the internet and have limited exposure to the globe, but students here have much more access to information. Park said as a child she thought dictator Kim Jong-un was starving and overworked until she was in South Korea and was shown pictures that showed how large he was in pictures compared to other people who looked thin and hungry. That's what it does when you're brainwashed. In some ways, they in the U.S. are brainwashed, even though there's evidence so clearly in front of their eyes they can't see it. Columbia University did not immediately respond to the Post's requests for comment. What a piece. And this was written by Mark Moore and Mark Lungariello. I am so grateful for Yenmi Park and what she's doing. Wow. So brave, so strong, and smart. And one of the things I love about this moment is that people from all walks of life are coming forward and pushing back. It's so needed right now. I hope you enjoyed getting to know her. I'm going to get that book, In Order to Live, In Order to Live by Yenmi Park. Thank you again. And by the way, the people at Freedom Fatigues, they're in this struggle too, to preserve our values as a country. And I think it would be great if you would support these people, okay? They've got a great product, a product with a message that's pro-American and pushing back against this madness we're in the middle of. Freedom Fatigues. Check them out. Freedom Fatigues. You know how to spell freedom. Fatigues is F-A-T-I-G-U-E-S. FreedomFatigues.com. Fantastic hoodies, shirts, hats with pro-American awesome graphics and slogans. I really love this stuff, and I'm wearing it all the time, and I'm triggering people all over the place, and I love it. Thanks so much for listening to Be Continued.